Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Select.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Howard Dean is hot on the campaign trail with the New Hampshire primary less than 3 months away now. He's promising to roll back the Bush tax cuts, expand health care coverage, and shake up Washington. Howard Dean is famously brash, bold in his views and criticisms, and ahead in an awful lot of polls. Tonight we begin the first in a series of programs talking with and about the top Democratic candidates. Howard Dean grew up in New York City, went to Yale and then Albert Einstein Medical School. He practiced medicine in Burlington, Vermont, where he became active in politics. He was elected lieutenant governor in 1986. In 1991, then-governor Richard Snelling died of a heart attack. Dean became governor of Vermont, expanded health care coverage, and supported the civil unions of gay couples. Now he wants to be your president. Tonight on Point, Howard Dean tells us why he deserves to run the country. We look at the man and his candidacy. Late Friday, I had the chance to speak with the Democratic presidential front-running candidate, Howard Dean. He talked with me about his run for the presidency. Howard Dean, you were with us in July last year, 2002. You were then essentially an unknown. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you just off the top, what do you think has propelled you to the front of the pack?
Two things. First of all, I think people are really worried about George Bush's presidency. We've got ourselves in Iraq. We can't seem to get out. He's cut taxes for the wealthy, and everybody else's property taxes and college tuitions have gone through the roof. He can't manage money. We've got the biggest deficit in the history of the country. We've lost 3 million jobs. People are pretty worried about that. Secondly, people are tired of Democrats who think that they're half Republicans, and they really want to have somebody who's willing to take on the president and change the country. And you're not going to get change in the country if you put somebody from Washington who's willing to say anything to keep the job, because when you're willing to say anything, the public doesn't trust you.
And yet, what do you make of the fact, Howard Dean, that a lot of Republicans seem to be rooting for your success in the Democratic Party? Karl Rove led a Go Howard cheer on the 4th of July. Why are Republicans rooting for you?
Well, you know what? There's some Republicans who really are rooting for us. When I was governor, we used to get about 30-35% of the Republican vote because of my fiscal management. I should really ask you that question. Why do you think Karl Rove would openly say that he'd like to get us? Do you think that's because he really means it?
Well, it might be.
Do you think that makes him a little nervous?
Maybe, but it may be for the same reason that some moderate Democrats, including, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council that helped propel Bill Clinton to power, also worry about Howard Dean. They say this is a man who's good in the early days, but in the home stretch he's going to be too brash and he's going to be too anti-war and too liberal and he won't make it over the final hump in the general election. What do you say
to that? Well, I don't think that people vote on you because you're anti-war, you're liberal, you're conservative. The truth is I've balanced budgets. None of the other candidates in this race have ever balanced a budget. I've delivered health care. None of the other candidates have ever delivered health care. I have a gun position that I'm sure the DLC would like, but John Kerry doesn't seem to like it since he just put out a position of paper whacking it. But that gun position allows me to be saleable in the South and the West and other candidates not to be. So I would argue that all this too liberal stuff comes down to one thing, and that's the war. And the truth is that the other folks in the race, General Clark and Senator Kerry and Senator Lieberman and Senator Edwards and all, they simply made the wrong choice. We're stuck over there. We got $87 billion going in there down a sinkhole, charged to our kids' credit card because there's no way to pay for this. The president doesn't seem to be willing to increase taxes for the wealthy in order to pay for it. So we've got a nation adrift, and the Democratic Party hadn't spoken up about it. That's what this is really about.
Howard Dean, when you're on the stump, you often say Americans are not as dumb as people in Washington think we are. What do you mean by that?
I think politicians in Washington talk down to voters. They focus group everything, they poll for everything, and then they tell us what we want to hear. We know what we think, but we want to know is what politicians think. And what I do differently is I say what I think, and some people don't like it, and they complain about it. And most of the ones doing the complaining are the ones that have been in Washington all this time with little to show for it.
So sit back with us for a second. What's your big vision for the country? What's the moment you see the United States at?
I think what this president has done is tear down the country by making it harder to defend ourselves and by embracing fiscal policies that are job killers. Here's what I want to do instead. Instead of giving corporations big tax breaks to then move their corporations, their headquarters to Bermuda and their jobs to China, I want to do something for small businesses. They create 7 out of 10 new jobs in this country, and they generally stay rooted in their community. I want to invest in renewable energy. I want to invest in roads and mass transit. I want to create jobs for people by putting together that infrastructure. And then when the economy starts to turn around, we'll have an infrastructure instead of giving tax cuts to the wealthiest people who put it in the stock market. The stock market is doing great, but average people's paychecks aren't. I want health insurance for every American. We've done that for everybody under 18 in my state, and one-third of our seniors have prescription benefits. We just got tired of waiting for Washington. The cost of that is $87 billion a year, the same as it costs to do Iraq. This is well within the means of a country if we're willing to go back to pay the same taxes we paid when Bill Clinton was president. And I don't remember those as being all that high. So I'm just going to take this country in a very different direction. We're going to have a foreign policy that's based on a strong defense, but not on being the world's policeman.
Let's pick those issues up one at a time, if we could, Howard Dean. You have said that you would reverse President Bush's 2001 and 2003 tax cuts.
Yep.
The economy in the third quarter grew at a sizzling 7.2% rate GDP. Isn't that proof that George Bush was right? He says he was.
That's proof that he was wrong. How many jobs did we gain in that period? None. We've lost 3 million jobs. You know, it doesn't matter how good the numbers are. That helps people on Wall Street, but it doesn't help the average American.
But sooner or later, that kind of growth brings jobs in its wake, doesn't it?
It hasn't so far, and the president will have an opportunity to prove that. We'll see how the numbers get. But the fact is, George Bush has cost us 3 million jobs. He's the first president since Herbert Hoover to be a net loser of jobs.
What do you think about this idea of turning back those tax cuts? You're not just looking at taking the tax cuts back for the rich, but for everybody. You've minimized the middle-class tax cut. Said what middle-class tax cut? But when you look at the numbers, you characterize the average as a $304 cut, but of course that includes people who pay little or no income tax. When you look at the numbers of families with children, 40% got a tax break ranging from $2,000 to $5,000. Those are pretty big numbers for an awful lot of Americans. Do you think Americans are ready to stand up and say, sure, take it away?
I think most Americans want tax fairness, and we're going to provide tax fairness. But most Americans also need health insurance. Most Americans need adequate job opportunities. Most Americans don't want to leave their children with a half a trillion dollar deficit. And certainly there's some people who've got a $5,000 tax cut. There are not very many. I have yet to meet one, other than the ones that make a lot of money. As I said, 60% of us got $304. Half the country got less than $100. That's not tax justice, and it's not tax fairness.
Health insurance. What exactly are you going to do? Bill Clinton tried and famously failed. What's your plan?
Our plan is different than Bill Clinton's, and it was designed with Harry and Louise in mind. You may remember Harry and Louise, mm-hmm. The actors who said how terrible Clinton's health care plan was. Ours is easy to understand, and instead of reforming the system, it uses the current system, including private insurance and public insurance, to cover everybody. And what we're going to do is model it after what we did in Vermont. If you're under 25, you can get into a government program and cover yourself. It's not expensive at all. In fact, it's probably going to cost close to nothing. And that's dirt cheap to do that. Young people don't run up a lot of health care bills in the aggregate. If you make less than $33,000 a year, you can get into a government program. If you're over 65, you get a prescription benefit that works, not like what the president's trying to pass. Now, let's just suppose you make $40,000 a year, you work for yourself. You can buy the same plan your congressman has for 7.5% of your income, which means less than $300 a month in insurance costs. You make $80,000, then you pay 7.5% of your income. That's a private plan. You can't be turned down for any pre-existing condition. If you have diabetes and heart disease, you can't be denied. And you pay community rate, which is the same, so the 58-year-old pays the same as a 27-year-old. Most of this stuff we've already done in my state. We know that it works. We don't put any private insurers out of business. We don't put insurance salesmen out of business. Some people would like to, but I frankly think it's impractical to take on every special interest in Washington at the same time. We don't plan to do it. We plan to cover everybody. As I said, the cost is $87 billion a year.
Can you do that without rolling back the tax cuts?
No, you cannot. This is why I disagree with Senator Kerry. He criticizes me for wanting to roll back the middle-class tax cuts. But the truth is, he is a sort of the old-school Washington politician. That is, promise him everything, and then if you don't deliver it afterwards, who cares? It is impossible to deliver health insurance for everybody, fund special education, and create jobs and balance the budget without rolling back the tax cut. He claims that that's not true. But the fact is, I know it's true. And the reason is that we wanted to leave the middle-class tax cuts. But we couldn't do it because our health care plan, which costs almost exactly what his costs, doesn't permit us to do both. We have to make choices in this country. You can have the tax cuts you got. If you think it's such a great tax cut, by all means, keep it and vote for George Bush. But if you think the $300 you got in tax cuts is not as important as having health insurance or reducing your property taxes by getting full funding for special education, then you ought to vote for Howard Dean.
Let's turn to foreign policy. Iraq's going to be a huge issue. What experience does a former doctor and Vermont governor bring to foreign policy issues, to national security?
the same experience that Bill Clinton had, Ronald Reagan had, George W. Bush had, and Jimmy Carter had. I've got great people advising me. And let me just say one thing about foreign policy experience. You know, Wes Clark, John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, John Edwards, and Dick Gephardt all supported the president's war. I did not. Now, I don't think that's the kind of foreign policy experience that we want in the White House. I think what we'd really need is somebody with patience and judgments who can look at the evidence. I figured out long before the other folks did that the president wasn't being truthful about why we were going. It was perfectly obvious to me that there was no Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. Turned out that was true, even though the president was trying to let us believe otherwise. Perfectly obvious to me that Iraq was not purchasing uranium from Africa. Turned out that I was right and everybody else was wrong. Now, the question is, on foreign policy expertise, here's how it works. You have experts. I have mine. Everybody else has theirs. They give you their opinions. The question is how you sort those opinions out. And I would maintain that my ability to make judgments and exercise patience is different than everybody else's, from the president to the five people I just named, Clark, Kerry, Gephardt, Edwards, and Lieberman. We came to different conclusions. I believe mine was the proper conclusion, that it was a mistake to go into Iraq. It's great to get rid of Saddam Hussein. It's going to cost us $87 billion a year for a long time, because now we can't get out.
Is it going to cost that even if Howard Dean becomes president? You've said that you would hand power in Iraq over to Iraqis. On what timeline should the U.S. exit Iraq altogether?
Well, see, what I've said is that I'll bring in Muslim troops from Arabic-speaking countries. We are going to obviously hand power over to Iraqis, but we can't do that before they're ready. While Al-Qaeda was not in Iraq before President Bush went in, they are there now. The president has made Iraq a much more dangerous situation for America than it was before. And if we leave and Al-Qaeda becomes a dominant force, that is a national security emergency for the United States, where one did not exist before. If we get a fundamentalist Shiite regime allied with Iran, that's a major national security problem for the United States. The proper exit strategy, I believe, which this president will not be able to exercise because he managed to humiliate everybody who disagreed with him on the way in, is to bring Arabic-speaking and Muslim troops into Iraq and bring home our Guard and Reserve and one of the two divisions. We're going to have a presence in Iraq for some time, because you don't create a democracy in a country with no history of democracy for 7,000 years.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Clinton couldn't solve it. Bush hasn't solved it. What would a President Dean do?
Well, Clinton came close. This is a very thorny issue, and Clinton ran out of time. I think the president is correct not to deal with Arafat. Arafat's not interested in making peace. He's interested in ruling, and he's a survivor. First thing I'd do is call Bill Clinton and ask him to go to the Middle East and begin the process again in a serious way.
Howard Dean, voters often ask you in town hall meetings about your temperament, about your temper. You're a brash guy. You speak your mind. But do you have an anger management problem?
I don't think so. I think that was mostly spun by other campaigns very early. And, you know, I think it's kind of amusing and interesting and fun. But I say what I think. You know, I was 12 years as governor. I never yelled at a staff member once. So I think that's a pretty reasonable thing. I've only been asked that actually once by a voter. But what happens in the national press is it gets into LexisNexis, and then people repeat the same story again and again. But the answer to your question is no.
And what about working with folks in Washington if you should gain the White House? You've compared Washington lobbyists to pigs and congressmen to cockroaches in a joshing way, but nevertheless, can you work with the people there if you should arrive there?
Well, first of all, I think you exaggerate the case. I've never compared congressmen to cockroaches. And I was jokingly talking about comparing Washington lobbyists to hogs, and in some ways they are hogs in the trough.
Well, you said if you won, members of Congress would, quote, scurry for shelter just like a giant flashlight on a bunch of cockroaches.
Exactly, that's not exactly what I said. What really happened was that I was asked about what would I do with members of Congress who were right-wing Republicans or Democrats who voted with Republicans who didn't agree with my platform and would be obstructionist. Mm-hmm. And that's when I said they'll scurry away, because the public won't put up with that. So, again, like I said, what happens in these stories is that, the press has a lot of fun with it, but usually there's a bit more to it than is written up in the papers.
Howard Dean, I know we just have you for another moment. What, in your mind, is the basic issue Americans are going to be considering when they decide whether or not to vote for you?
Jobs and job opportunity. Are you willing to stand up for what you believe in? Are you willing to create jobs, or are you simply making empty promises for the sake of being president? We're not going to beat somebody who stands next to George Bush who's willing to make empty promises. And if people don't believe the things I say, all they got to do is go to look at my record in Vermont, because most of the things that I'm talking about have already been done in my state. Balanced budgets, job creation, health insurance, environmental protection, help for kids. Those things we've done, and it's time to do that for the whole country.
Howard Dean, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
presidential candidate Howard Dean. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you want to know, need to know about Howard Dean, the man, the governor, the candidate for the White House? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be back with much more. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with and about front-running Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. You can join the conversation. Do you support Howard Dean? Why? Do you oppose him? Why? Can Dean win against his Democratic contenders? Can he win against George W. Bush? And how do you explain Howard Dean's rocket ride to the forefront of that pack? We just spent 15 minutes talking with Howard Dean. It was a taped recording of a conversation I had with him late Friday. Joining me now in the studio is Sarah Schweitzer, who is covering the Howard Dean campaign for the Boston Globe. Good evening and welcome, Sarah Schweitzer.
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. Joining us from Norwich, Vermont is Kathy Hoyt, who from 1997 to 2002 was Governor Howard Dean's top cabinet official, and from 91 to 97, his chief of staff. She's worked closely with Howard Dean for the last 17 years. Good evening and welcome, Kathy Hoyt.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Peedy. And Jack, I wonder if you can give us your response to what we just heard, a little bit there from Howard Dean himself.
Well, you know, I think the most useful concept in politics is the double-edged sword. All issues, personas, positions, stances are double-edged swords for politicians. And with Howard Dean, I think there are three: taxes, anger, and war. On taxes, he is credible on the deficit and on all these other things. He wants to recall the Bush tax cut for Homeland Security, job creation, health care, and budget and dealing with the deficit. That's laudable from the point of view of public finance and responsible positions. On the other hand, it leaves him very vulnerable to George Bush because, as you said, Tom, these tax cuts, the child tax credit, it meant at least $1,000 and more
to
a lot of families. Second, anger. His anger against the Democrats. He came to the public consciousness when he said, "I represent the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party." Then he said, "What are Democrats doing agreeing with George Bush?" That has really propelled him in the Democratic primary, in the polls. On the other hand, in the November election, will that put off independent voters? And finally, the war. I mean, he's right. He was right on the war, and the others were wrong, although I think he mischaracterizes General Clark. But on the other hand, unless either he or Clark are candidates, we're not going to be able to vote on this war. This won't really be a basic issue. The other candidates are pretty much in agreement with Bush, although they'll pretend not to be. So that's important to give the voters a real choice. But on the other hand, we know that George Bush will drape himself in the bloody shirt of our slain soldiers and will make that a very hard case for Howard Dean to argue.
So tax cuts, anger, and war all cutting two ways. Sarah Schweitzer, you've written a great, big, detailed bio of this man. I wish you'd just spend a few minutes with us here and give us the 5-minute version of the life of Howard Dean. Who is Howard Dean? What kind of family and background has he come from? Take us right from the get-go and give us that picture, if you would.
Sure. Howard Dean is a man who comes from a family that has very deep roots in this country. His family came to New York in the 1600s. And they settled in New York and Connecticut. Eventually, they had roots in Sag Harbor, which is sort of a village in Long Island. And his relatives made large sums of money on Wall Street from an early period. And
so how early? When did the family come into money?
In the about 1800s. Mm-hmm. The first,
so pretty far back.
The first dean made his way into Wall Street. There are four generations that have made their way in the financial district in New York. And his father, in fact, did the same, working for Dean Witter Reynolds. And he was a pretty top executive there. And
so did he grow up as a rich kid? How and where?
Howard Dean grew up on Park Avenue in New York. He likes to think that he actually grew up in East Hampton. If you ask him where he grew up, he says he grew up in the country. Mm-hmm. He prefers to think, I think, of East Hampton is home. It's where his family spent weekends.
So they had two homes. They had a summer house or a weekend house on
right.
Long Island and a and a city house on Park Avenue, a pretty glossy address.
It was a very nice place to live, and I think that Howard Dean acknowledges that, and I think he appreciates the privilege that he was born into, but he also likes to think that his family appreciated it and didn't take it for granted.
What was the family culture of his childhood? What was prized? What was considered important?
Well, he grew up in a family of four boys, first off, which I think says something about sort of the liveliness of the house. His father, like I said, was a Wall Street banker and worked long hours, and I think believed very much that hard work and putting time into his work was important, which Howard Dean, I think, embraced later on. His mother had married his father at a young age, about 18, mm-hmm. had left Barnard to marry him and stayed home with the boys.
Where does Howard fall in the birth order?
He is the oldest.
Mm-hmm. So firstborn son.
Mm-hmm. And strangely, or oddly, I suppose, his second brother was the one who was considered the politician of the family. Charlie was the boy who was supposed to grow up and sort of give himself over to public service. And
Why not Howard? What was Howard Dean's early character?
Howard was much tamer than Charlie. Charlie was the outspoken one of the boys. He was the one who tended to take on Big Howard, as their father was called. Big Howard was a big personality and very blustery and very much given to sort of antic humor. And Charlie was the boy who took on his father's conservative politics and tended to confront his father more, whereas Howard tended to stay in the background and try to, as much as he could, not anger his father.
School? What kind of student was Howard Dean?
Howard Dean was a decent student. I'm not sure what his grades were when he was in elementary and high school. He went to prep schools, one in Rhode Island. When he went to Yale, he said himself that his grades were nothing spectacular.
And then medical school. Why?
Well, it was sort of a long transition for him. He left Yale and was a bit confused as to what he wanted his life to look like. He went to Aspen for about 10 months and skied and washed dishes and had not a lot of purpose, which he fully concedes now. And he came back to New York and he still was sort of searching for something to do. And he went to work on Wall Street, did that for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and decided that really wasn't what was, and you know, making him inspired, I suppose.
He didn't want to walk in his father's shoes.
I think that he wanted to, and I think he couldn't. I think that he wanted to please his father. His father never told him that he should go to Wall Street, but his father definitely, in a silent sort of way, gave a lot of appreciation when Governor Dean decided to go to Wall Street. And when that didn't work out,
Meaning he just didn't feel comfortable there. He didn't have the aptitude for it.
But two things: one was he went during a recession, so he had a sort of bum time. So
when was that?
It was during the 72-73 era. Mm-hmm. So he really didn't have much
luck.
It wasn't
fun that way.
It wasn't fun, and he also didn't do it for him. I don't think that it made him feel fulfilled or satisfied in the way that he wanted from his career. So he sort of searched deep inside and decided that medical school was something that he wanted. He'd volunteered at a hospital near his apartment in the West Village, mm-hmm. and that had been something that for some reason clicked with him. He liked the pace of the emergency room. He liked helping people. And those two things combined made him think medical school was the answer.
When did he marry?
He married maybe 10 years later. He married a woman that he dated in medical school, Dr. Judith Steinberg. They married in Burlington when both of them were doing their residency up there.
And get us from medical school graduation to the governorship of Vermont.
It was an interesting ride for him. He went to Vermont with a plan to practice internal medicine, and which he did.
Why Vermont?
Well, he had chosen in the sort of match process as part of medical school, you list different programs that you'd be interested in, two of which were in New York, but he didn't get chosen for those. But his third choice was Vermont, which happens to have a particular program in outpatient care that's a component of internal medicine, and mm-hmm. he was particularly interested in that kind of practice. So he went to Vermont, and he did his residency for 3 years. But midway through, he began to dabble in politics. And it was sort of a very slow beginning, but quickly built. And the momentum carried him basically to the governorship. It started when, in 1980, he became involved with the Carter campaign and befriended a woman who lived around the block from him by the name of Esther Sorrell, who is a very important figure in the Democratic Party in Vermont.
So Howard Dean was always a Democrat?
That's open to question. He says that he believes he's been a Democrat since the time of his teens, there's no real way to document it because his voting records don't really reflect that. His father, of course, was a Republican, a staunch Republican. Mm-hmm. And from the time he was in college, it seems as though his leanings were with the Democratic Party.
And the political positions he held after that participation in Carter's campaign?
Well, it started out with a seat in the legislature. He represented his district. Then he became the minority whip in the House. In 86, he was elected lieutenant governor. And in 1991, Governor Richard Snelling died, and he assumed the position.
Kathy Hoyt, you've known Howard Dean through a lot of this history and a lot we haven't talked about yet. When did you first meet him, and what kind of man did you take him to be in those early days?
I met him way back in the 80s. I met him during the Carter campaign. At that point, I was the Windsor County Committee chair in the Democratic Party, and so I met him way back then. I worked with him some. I remember when he was in the legislature, he was on the education committee. Mm-hmm. And I began to work with him off and on when he was in the legislature, particularly after I started working in Madeline Cunin's administration. I ended up heading the labor department in Vermont. It's called the Department of Employment and Training. And in that capacity, I worked a lot on strengthening supports for families who wanted jobs. And so Howard Dean, in the legislature, he and I worked together to create the Vermont Conservation Corps, which was a program for youth, low-income youth at that point, that gave them experience in a job primarily aimed at assisting with the environment. We ended up building trails. We ended up restoring town hiking trails and bike paths and taking care of forest a lot in the Vermont community.
The two big issues he's known for during that time, Kathy Hoyt, are Vermont's health care program, and gay civil union legislation. Right. How did each of those come onto his fork during his time as governor?
Clearly, when he became governor, he always had – I remember the first few weeks we were in office, and I went with him on the day that he was sworn in as governor. I started working in his administration as chief of staff. I remember he pulled out a list of things he wanted to accomplish, health care for children and for families who couldn't get health care in Vermont was at the top of his agenda. And in the early days when he was involved with the National Governors Association and when Clinton was working on health care, we watched very carefully what was going on at the national level. In fact, Howard Dean proposed a comprehensive health plan in Vermont, which would have covered everybody and which would have been built on making sure that we used employer-sponsored health care. When that failed, he immediately switched gears. We got a waiver from the federal government. We started taking as many incremental steps as we could to put health care in the hands of families and children in Vermont to the greatest extent we could. 96% of the kids in Vermont, through his efforts, are covered by health care. About a third of the seniors receive help, not only with basic health care if they're low income, but also they receive prescription help. So he made that a program that was of top priority to him, and Vermonters really appreciated that focus.
And gay civil unions, how did that come onto his agenda?
There was a decision by the Vermont Supreme Court which said that the Constitution, the common clause of the Constitution in Vermont, said that everybody should be entitled to equal benefits, and gave the charge to the legislature to come up with a way that we could make sure that same-sex unions were respected in the way that all unions were, that people were entitled to the same rights.
So, in effect, he had to act on that. It was a court decision.
It was a court decision. And it was something that that essentially was the responsibility of the Judiciary Committees in the House and Senate. And it's something that Howard Dean weighed in on from the very first day that the Supreme Court put down its decision.
Kathy Hoyt, you've worked with Howard Dean for so long. Are you surprised to find him, A, running for president and being something like a front runner here?
I knew way back that he was interested in more than just what was going on in Vermont. He expressed some interest in higher office back in the late 90s. He decided that it was not the time to put his flag up, and began to think about what he would do in the future. In September 2001, he actually let the state Democratic Party and the state of Vermont know that he was interested in higher office and that he would not seek another term as governor. At that point, Howard Dean had served longer than any modern-day governor, and it felt like we should give the party and the state plenty of time to go about a debate about who should take his place as governor in the future years.
So fair warning was given. We're talking about Howard Dean tonight. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Josh is calling from Laconia, New Hampshire. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Josh, and I have a question for Ms. Hoyt. We've been hearing a lot about how Howard Dean was really a strong moderate for 11 years as governor, and how he suddenly turned into a liberal now that he's running for president. So I guess from the perspective of somebody who's worked with him, has he really changed his position on things? Or have people just assumed that he's really liberal because he came out so early and so strongly against Bush on Iraq?
Josh, good question. Kathy Hoyt?
If you really knew Howard Dean, you knew that he was liberal in a lot of the social causes. He was very conservative when it came to money. He was one of these people that realized if you're not a person who cares about balancing the budget and creating resources to invest in social programs, you're not going to get anywhere. He was, I think that what happened is that as he spoke what he really thought about this war in Iraq, that a lot of people began to label him as very liberal, and that they didn't quite look at the full rounded picture. Of course, also the decisions that that were made by the Supreme Court, which actually brought some action on civil unions, which, as Howard Dean said, everybody in the state of Vermont struggled with that issue. It was the right thing to do. And because he had the courage of his convictions, he didn't back away from the fact that people should have equal rights. Mm. A lot of people labeled him a super liberal. I think when people look at Howard Dean and his entire record, they'll see that there's a person there who has had an extraordinary experience being governor for as long as he was and has a lot to offer to the nation.
Sarah Schweitzer, what about this issue of liberal conservative Howard Dean? There's some kind of ambiguity here.
Well, I think like any politician, you know, he's got certain positions that are firm and clear, and then there's some others that are something in the middle. And he's been taken to task in recent days for a position that he took on assault weapons. The National Rifle Association put a candidate questionnaire to him in 1992 on which he signed off and said, no, I don't support any restrictions on assault weapons.
He turned around after the 94 restrictions. And we've got the comments over the weekend about the Confederate flag in the back of the pickup truck. We'll come back to that. We're talking tonight with and about front-running Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. You can join the conversation. Is he too liberal, too angry, too small town to win? Or is he just the ticket for a victory? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with and about front-running Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. What do you think? Have you been watching? Is this your guy or not? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Sarah Schweitzer. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe covering the Howard Dean campaign. And by Kathy Hoyt. She joins us from Vermont. She was chief of staff for Howard Dean from 91 to 97 when he was governor of Vermont, and from 97 to 2002, Dean's top cabinet official. You can join the conversation as well. What do you make of the Howard Dean candidacy? Steve's calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I think Howard Dean is a great candidate for consolidating the Democratic vote. When he was in Vermont, he was able to deal with the independent and progressive parties to get that vote consolidated. But the minute he declared that he wasn't going to run, the State House went back over to the Republicans because primarily of the split between the Democratic, independent, and progressive parties.
So what's the lesson? What lesson do you take from that, Steve?
Well, I take it that somebody has to consolidate the vote. Gore is the same situation last year. The Democrats seem to have a problem with consolidating the Democratic or the liberal vote. And I think Howard Dean is a good crossover person who can actually do that. I'd like to see if your guests agree with that or not.
But when he left office, you're saying it went back to Republicans. So what's the lesson there?
Well, the lesson there is that Dean was able to consolidate that Democratic vote to keep himself in office. But when he left, for one reason or another, the independents and the progressives against the Democratic candidates took, I think it was 8 or 9% of the vote, which was enough to swing the election.
Got it. Sarah Schweitzer, what's the lesson in this? And thanks for your call, Steve. But what's the lesson here? Does this mean when he wants to, Howard Dean can go out and pull together that big tent that the Democrats need to first to win the nomination and second to win the White House?
Well, I think that the situation in Vermont was something of a unique one. When he took the last in 2000, when he won his final election with just 50.5% of the vote, the civil unions issue had split that state and very dramatically mm-hmm. so. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something of a unique situation. On the issue of whether or not he can do it now, I think that's really what the big question is. He certainly has drawn into his circle the disaffected Democrats who feel that the 2000 election was stolen from them, the Democrats who feel that the war was a wrong thing to do and that their voice wasn't heard. He has that vote, and he has it certainly in New Hampshire and certainly in Iowa, but the question is whether or not he can expand that and grab voters who are more in the middle and who aren't as angry.
Kathy Hoy, what do you say? You know that advisors to Lieberman and Kerry are forecasting the worst kind of catastrophe if Howard Dean wins the nomination, 49-state defeat. Yet we've got a Vermont caller here saying he was a great consolidator in this state. What do you imagine is coming?
He was a great consolidator in this state, and I believe that he's the kind of candidate, when you look at all of his positions, he is a person who can be a moderate on the fiscal issues and help people understand the differences and build on key values of fairness. And I believe that's what people are looking for. I think they want to be treated fair in their tax system. They want to be treated fair in the economy. And he's passionate. This is one man who's passionate when he sees there's an issue of fairness. He will, that's when you hear the anger in his voice. I worked for this guy for 11 and a half years in very close advisory positions in his administration. He's right. He didn't yell at staff. He would yell about issues sometimes because he felt it was so unfair, and he would speak out very passionately about those issues. That shouldn't scare people off. I think he can speak to the person who's on the street. He can talk about the problems that they're facing in the economy. He's learned firsthand in Vermont what it's like to be in a state where the median income was under $30,000, where he had to put himself on the line to create jobs and to make opportunities for folks. I think when people around the country listen to him and hear what he's done and hear what he wants to do for America, that he can be that consolidator.
Jack Beatty, what do you see, a consolidator here or ultimately a divider?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, his vote, at least the polls show, tends upscale. He does very well among Democrats earning over $70,000. And that is a group that sort of blends off into independent voters. One poll I saw of his vote as against General Clark's was that he did better among women slightly than General Clark, but the General Clark did something like 23 points better among white males, working class, that is lower middle income, in the South. Now, if you had to identify any metric in any demographic in the society that the Democrats need, don't have, and need, it would be white male, low income people in the South who have more or less deserted the party. And to carry any of those Southern states, they need to get some of that vote. Now, that would argue that the General Clark would be the better candidate from them. On the other hand, the same polls show that Dean does a little better among independents. So I think a lot of Democrats are going to have to start thinking to themselves, who's electable? I mean, people say you don't vote for a guy because he's electable. But in the end, a lot of people do if they really want Bush out. And these sorts of questions, on the one hand and on the other hand, are going to get into it.
Sarah Schweitzer, Howard Dean seems very aware of exactly this issue. His comments over the weekend, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but it was something along the lines of, we've got to reach out to that guy in his pickup truck in the South with the Confederate flag in the back window, suggests that he's ready to reach out or try to exactly that constituency.
That's true, and I think that he really does believe that down South it's going to be very important to make sure that the Democratic Party makes its tent as big as possible, and I think that he really does hope that he can bring in voters of various different sort of positions within the Democratic Party, although it seems as though, you know, right now he's drawing, as Jack was saying, these elites and these sort of very angry Democrats, and the guy in the truck in South Carolina, which will be a pivotal voter come February 3rd, you know, it's hard to say where he is right now.
What have you seen when Howard Dean gets out with the public at big gatherings, when it's not an elite crowd, whatever exactly people mean by that, they'll have different definitions, but when he rolls up his sleeves and he's with the crowd and it's a working class crowd, does it work?
Well, I was with him in Iowa where he was talking to a lot of farmers and a lot of folks that work in some heavy machinery plants that are located there. And it seemed as though his message was resonating. He's taken a tack that his position on NAFTA that he embraced when he was governor of Vermont may have not actually been the best idea for the rest of the country, and that he's reconsidered that. And that,
so that means a kind of hedging on free trade?
Well, he initially said that he embraced NAFTA and now says that he thinks that the trade treaty should be renegotiated, reopened, so that safety regulations and other laws that we have here in the United States are part of laws down in Mexico and in Canada.
You got a big union endorsement just last week from the Service Employees International, biggest union in the AFL-CIO.
I think that that's supposed to come
Right, it's coming,
up or down.
But
it's up or down, but it's definitely going to be for him if it's going to be anybody.
Poised to get it.
Exactly.
Right. So it worked in that setting, you're saying?
I think it did. I think these guys that I was talking to out there seemed to think that his position was reasonable, and they seemed to think that it offered them some comfort when they're very worried about losing their jobs right now.
Laura's calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask about, is it Dr. Steinberg, his wife?
Judith Steinberg, yes. Howard Dean's wife, yeah?
And I wanted to ask about her effect on his electability, and I guess I'll be as blunt as I can be. I don't see necessarily the truck driver in South Carolina accepting her as a first lady.
Why not, Laura?
Well, I'll be really blunt. She's a she doesn't, you know, she wants to have her own career, and I honestly am not sure that being Jewish she can be. She's not dolled up. She hasn't dyed her hair. I'm saying this as a Jewish female myself, but I honestly think that that might be a bar to his being elected.
You're wondering about the impact of that. She said very clearly, Kathy Hoyt, that she doesn't want to be the kind of show wife, first lady. She wants to go ahead, if and when Howard Dean is elected, with her medical career, continue her practice. Kathy Hoyt, how did that play out in their years when he was governor of Vermont? How do you imagine it might play out in the election ahead?
I think in Vermont it played just fine. I think we're at a stage in this country where women can have their own careers, and that clearly Howard Dean respects and appreciates her dedication to her practice and really doesn't want her to have to give that up. I think that's a great statement for women in this country. I think Judy can pull it off, if anybody could. It is full of challenges. I realize that, and I know she realizes that. But I believe it also is a good example for where we've come in this country in terms of women and their own careers.
Jack Beatty,
and maybe this is something that can work.
Maybe so. Jack, what do you think? It, admirable as it may be, does it put Howard Dean kind of out front of the mainstream population and what they're ready and willing to see in a first lady?
Well, that's the question. It also deprives him of a force multiplier, to use the military expression. You look at C-SPAN and you see presidential candidates' wives are on the stump night and day. I mean, or Dick Gephardt with his daughter now. I watched last night. She was in Concord and then Dover, New Hampshire. Mrs. Lieberman, you see her on all the time. I don't know. I haven't seen much of John Kerry's wife. But the presidential candidate's wife is often thought of as an important, you know, part of his campaign. And if Governor Dean is going to forfeit that, I don't know what the effect of that is. But that will be something relatively new.
And, Jack, our caller Laura asks about Mrs. Dean's Jewishness. Has Joe Lieberman put that to bed already? Is that an issue that's behind the electorate?
Oh, I hope so. I really do. But I can understand her sensitivity on that point.
Dan's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I feel that I'm about as liberal a Democrat as comes. But I find there's something about Howard Dean that really turns me off. I don't find any warmth in the guy. It's always hostile with him. And when I see him responding, listening to other candidates on the debates, he's sort of smirking. And I want to beat Bush more, you know, as much as any liberal Democrat, but I just don't think this guy is the guy to do it.
So you're not thrilling to the fire of Howard Dean. You're looking for some warmth around the personality there.
I don't even see a whole lot of fire, to tell you the truth. I just find him kind of sullen and angry all the time, and I don't really see much of a vision.
Kathy Hoyt, how about it? You were known in Vermont as Howard Dean's smoother. Does he ruffle feathers? Can he warm people up? Can he be, I don't know if presidential candidates need to be lovable, but there's some kind of Q factor of likability. Does he have it?
I think he can be very affable when he wants to be. You know, he's in a very tough job to distinguish himself from these other Democratic candidates. He's got an incredible energy. He perseveres. He tries to listen to people. He's certainly got ideas about the way things he wants to do with the economy, with job creation, with taxes in terms of the fairness issues. He wants to do a lot of things which would touch all of our lives. Mm. I think if you've been to one of his rallies, if you've been followed him around some of these communities in Iowa and New Hampshire, he excites the audience. He really has an energy that just pulls you in to his campaign.
Let me put it to Sarah Schweitzer. Sarah, if it should end up, Howard Dean and George Bush, how will this candidate, do you think, look next to President Bush, the incumbent, the angry man or the magnetic alternative?
Well, I think one thing that distinguishes Howard Dean as a candidate in any field is that he is very adamant about keeping his personal biography separate from the campaign trail. When he's asked questions about his background, he's very careful in offering up only so many details. And a lot of times he'll get asked a personal question and he'll divert it into more of a policy speech.
Does that leave him feeling unwarm?
Well, I'm wondering if that's something that this caller might have been feeling. It's certainly something that's striking, and I think that it comes across very clearly when you're with him that he is not particularly eager to talk about a lot about his life.
And yet, there's an awful lot of support out there for him right now. The polls show it, the money shows it, the standing shows it. Howard Dean is going to be a big force to be contended with. Sarah Schweitzer, thanks so much for being with
us
tonight.
My pleasure.
And Kathy Hoyt, thanks very much to you.
Thank you for having me.
Kathy Hoyt was Howard Dean's chief of staff and top cabinet officer in Vermont. Sarah Schweitzer is a reporter for the Boston Globe. She covers the Howard Dean campaign. Jack Beatty, what do you think?
Well, there's a bumper sticker up here in New Hampshire that a lot of candidates could have. It says, Dated Dean, Married Kerry.
Well, we'll ponder that one. Jack, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.